is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Well, the Mueller report was released on Thursday, but it looks like investigate versus legislate. But at least the markets were relieved. Stocks up, bonds down this week, and oil prices holding firm. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. My good friend Frank Barbera will join me in Hour 1. Frank thinks there's a good possibility markets could head higher and take out those old highs reached last October. But also, he thinks it's time to take some money or chips off the table. Later on in the program, Keith Barron will join me as we take a look at the precious metals market. He thinks the position or the fundamentals for copper are set up to be great, and why, if you're investing in the gold sector, where you need to place your bets. And of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
And in Hour 2, the big picture, marijuana, lucrative leaf or harmful herb? On this edition of the big picture, Jim Poplava and I, we get into the weeds on the marijuana debate. We also talk about legalization, cannabis companies going public, and big tobacco and beverage companies investing in those companies. Also, the possibility of legalization at the federal level. Possible harmful effects of cannabis. And though the U.S. has 5% of the world population, we have 25% of the world's incarcerated. How do recent changes in cannabis laws relate to America's devastating mass incarceration problem? We discuss all of that in Hour 2, The Big Picture. And now we have Ryan Poplava with what moved the markets this week.
You know, Chris, it was pretty ho-hum during the market this week. Earnings have come in better than expected, which actually is to be expected as the bar was set pretty low. But earnings were expected to fall 4.5%. And now that companies are announcing, we're starting to see that that's being revised higher. And I expect that will continue throughout this earnings season. So it's a really good sign. All the worries and concerns about a earnings recession, maybe those will be alleviated. We'll see. So far, earnings growth is up 5.5% for the companies that have reported thus far, which is just over 10% of the companies in the S&P 500. Now, there were a few catalysts this week, but none really moved the market. For a market that is up double digits, mainly due to multiple expansion and just near all-time highs for some of the large cap indices like the S&P 500 and the Dow Jones Industrial Average, you know, it's just time to pause. You know, we feel a lot that has to do with the market coming back so substantially has been share buybacks in. And right now we're going through that blackout period that we tend to always go through right before earnings start. In fact, not really many know this, but according to a recent research from Goldman Sachs, corporations have been the largest source of equity demand from 2014 to the end of last year. In fact, S&P 500 firms repurchased around $811 billion of stock in 2018, just to put a number with the claim. And that represented around 30% of total cash spending by corporations in the S&P 500. Now, March 22nd of last year, the Senate discussed prohibiting companies from repurchasing shares. And that would be, I think, just devastating to the market. Let's move on. The economic reports this week were fine and matched the current slow growth expectation we have. You know, the Empire Manufacturing Survey was up to 10.1 from 3.7 last month with a pickup in new orders. But the Philadelphia Fed survey dropped to 8.5. Not a big drop, but nonetheless. Industrial production dropped slightly, down 0.1% in March. Inventories increased in February, which outpaced sales, kind of keeping a lid on prices. Now, the Fed Beige Book comes out, I believe, every quarter, said most districts saw growth, but overall activity was slight to moderate. They said manufacturing contacts said inflationary pressures were muted, but tariffs continue to drive up prices. And on Thursday, initial claims dropped to record lows, down 5,000 to 192,000 total. Now, retail sales rebounded sharply in March, and that really alleviated a lot of concerns that investors have had on the economy with that announcement on Thursday. It was up 1.6%. That was the strongest gain that the retail sales index has seen since September of 2017. And then the conference board's LEIs, that's the leading economic indicators, were up 0.4% in March. And if you look at the trajectory of the LEIs, they've all been rising for the past few months now, and that bodes well for the second quarter. Now let's take a look at earnings. You know, so far, according to Bloomberg, 79% of the S&P 500 companies that have reported so far have beat earnings estimates with positive earnings growth for the quarter. But we still have 421 companies more to go. So this is just the start of things just this week and last week's on the with the financials, bulk of which of those 421 companies will be announcing over the next couple of weeks. But thus far, like I said earlier, the response has been kind of ho-hum to positive earnings growth. And that's probably because a lot of this has been discounted. You know, the market's gone up quite a bit, like I said, on multiple expansion. But commenting on this very thing was Larry Fink, as CEO of BlackRock, the world's largest asset manager. He sees a risk of actually a melt up in stocks versus a meltdown, with central banks more dovish than ever. Now, that seemed to cause some buying interest early in the week, but I've seen it as definitely a conversation starter in the media. A lot of conversation revolving around this whole idea of possibly a melt up and why. The reasons, I think, not just about the Fed being dovish, but I continue to hear in the media about the excessive levels of cash in investors' accounts right now, and even in institutions. I was just at a conference in LA where some of the panelists talking on equities were saying the very same thing. So another CEO comment I found very interesting this week, obviously after earnings were announced, was from David Wichmann, who warned that Medicare for All would destabilize the healthcare system. And of course, this was off of Bernie Sanders' most recent proposal for a single-payer healthcare system. Now, possibly self-serving, yes, for a healthcare company to make that statement, but healthcare originally rallied with the market in January, but stopped cold in the first part of March. And this has been an area of some concern, but a good chunk of the recent correction that the sector has seen and what was driving some of the weakness in the market earlier this week, most of this has been hit in just this recent week. So it was hitting areas like pharmaceuticals, health insurers, biotech, and medical technology companies. So just a wide swath being hit with weakness with these fear concerns over a single-payer system. Now, in the Investor's Business Daily article I read Thursday, it reported an Evercore analyst, Umar Raffet, referencing a white paper from Sanders that a family earning $250,000 paying 24% in taxes now would have to go up to 40% to pay for Medicare for All. And that would obviously hurt the economy. One last thing to mention, more big IPOs hit the street this week, including Pinterest and Zoom. Pinterest is raising around $1.4 billion from this IPO at the current price, and that values the company around $12 billion. And the market appeared to be ending on a bad note on healthcare weakness, but given what we had seen in the IPO market on Thursday, things had kind of reversed. But the addition of two successful IPOs really encouraged, I think, the bulls to defend 2900 yet again. And obviously, looking at what has happened to Lyft since its IPO, this was encouraging that, you know, there is still some animalistic demand for some of these high value unicorns in the market right now.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
Now we're talking about serious stuff. It seems to be all coming to a head because you can't continue this borrowing like this. You can't continue to have demand-side economics where we're going to raise interest rates to bring down inflation when the U.S. government is the biggest borrower. Nothing works. There's nothing that's functioning anymore. And this confrontation between the left and the right is just only going to get worse. And I don't see it being resolved. And I think ultimately you end up with some sort of political upset, revolution, whatever it is. You know, it's the system is doomed. That's it. It cannot function like this indefinitely.
We know life never travels in a straight line. Plans change and sometimes you find yourself heading in a new direction. Let Financial Sense Wealth Management help you prepare for the unexpected. Our financial advisors, acting as fiduciaries for our clients, can provide guidance and sound financial advice.
Contact a Financial Sense advisor today and begin your path to retirement. Call Financial Sense Wealth Management at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, stocks seem to be having another good year. Question now is, are we going to be taking out the old highs reached in last October? Will this rally continue, or will it stall, or maybe pause? Either direction, let's find out why. Joining me on the program is Frank Barbera from the Gold Stock Technician. Frank, let's begin with the major indexes. I don't care if you're looking at the Dow, the NASDAQ, the S&P. It looks like they want to take out the highs reached in, last October. Is that a good possibility?
It's a very realistic possibility. I think that's exactly what we're looking at this stage of the game. The NASDAQ in particular is extremely close. Both the S&P and the NASDAQ are extremely close. But I think there's a pretty good chance that the NASDAQ composite is going to take out the old highs right around the 8,100 mark. And we're hovering just below those levels right now. Probably you'll get some kind of downside reaction on the order of, a few percentage points, maybe 4 or 5% on the NASDAQ, maybe 1.5 to 3% on the S&P. If we do make a new high, I wouldn't be surprised to see a little selling come into the market and for the market to back off a little bit. Ultimately, the bigger question is going to be, are we still in a longer range bull market? Or is this the right side of a potential double top? And that's a fairly serious risk at this moment in time. The reason is this. Last year, when in 2017 and 2018, when the market was moving up, it was moving up relentlessly. Earlier in January of 2018, the market had a big spike in late December 2017 into late January 2018. It had sort of a vertical move. And then there was a correction that lasted into April of 2018. That correction drew down some of the medium-term momentum at the time, but then there was residual upside momentum left in the market. And that's why you got that push up into new highs in October of last year. What's happening on a major trend basis now is that the entire advance from 2012 to 2018, that huge leg up had a tremendous amount of momentum in it. And the crack that we saw in the market last year between October and December of last year, which was a fairly vicious 15 to 16% decline in the major average, that really drew down a lot of long-term momentum. And the problem is what is typical in that scenario is when you draw down long-term momentum, there's always like an echo move. There's an echo, there's residual momentum. The market keeps going. It's like a ball going up in the air. You hit sort of maximum velocity. But then at some point, that ball is going up, but it's going up with less inertia. And then eventually it comes to a point where it just stops going up and it starts to fall. It's a little calculus, but effectively right now we're in that residual leg where this is sort of a lot, even though it's been a very strong rally on a major trend basis, it's taking place against a backdrop of weakening long-term momentum. And so there's a risk that you could build a double top up here. And I would suggest that would probably look like a plateau on something like the QQQ, just to use a widely watched ETF. I would peg intermediate term support at this stage of the game about 182 and an overhead resistance, a likely topping zone around 192. So I think that 192 to 182 range might actually prevail on the QQQ for a couple of months here, maybe into late June. And if the market isn't able to really at some point take that out and we start breaking the low end of that range, that would be a first potential indication that we could be seeing a longer range double top in things like the Qs, the NASDAQ, the S&P. At the moment, I would say the trend is up, but very extended, and it's also getting very overbought. Just three days ago, we saw the NASDAQ composite recording the lowest puts to calls premium ratio, and this is a dollar weighted puts to calls premium ratio in history. So I tracked this back about 20 years, and we saw extreme optimism on the QQQ contract. The same thing is also present in the S&P. So you have a lot of call buying, very little put buying. Call premiums are inflated relative to put premiums. On the daily chart, things like the stocks only McClellan Oscillator, operating company only McClellan Oscillator, up to down volume ratio. These are diverging against the higher highs that we're getting right now in the averages. In a short-term sense, they're not making new highs. Those kinds of divergences are usually red flags that you're getting close to some kind of a pullback. Again, I don't think in the near term we're really looking at anything that deep. The probably 182 area on the Qs is going to be shaping up like a support area, I think, for a number of weeks. But if we do get up into the low 190s, I wouldn't be surprised to see the Qs selling off from something like 192 to 182 over a period of 2 or 3 weeks, which is like a 5% pullback on the NASDAQ. The volume, the ARMS index is also at record lows. This tells me that the market has the ability to hold up for a while, but I ultimately think it's probably going to end up building some kind of an important high. Probably a lot will depend on what happens with the trade negotiations with China and whether there's really a meaty deal that comes out of that or whether we end up compromising for a sort of a headline deal without as much depth. And I think the quality of the deal is something that will ultimately be scrutinized if there even is a deal. I noticed last week Lighthizer was saying that while they're optimistic, he also made a comment that there was, quote, still a lot of work to do on major points. And so it sounds like on some of these things, like the transfer of technology and intellectual property, whether that's really going to get hashed out or not, I think the jury is still sort of open on that.
Frank, when you see what we saw last year, where you saw this sharp V-spike bottom, and then, of course, beginning this year, we've had this sharp V-spike return. What is that telling you about the nature of the market? I mean, it happened rather suddenly. I mean, if you would have looked at October, we were hitting new highs. The economy was humming along. Corporate profits were growing at 25%. And then all of a sudden, almost a 20% correction in oil. Oil prices dropped 40%. And then we start out January, the Fed reverses course. And here we are where we are today with a double-digit return. And it happened just as quickly.
That's right. No, there's no doubt about that, Jim. This is very, very familiar in terms of being reminiscent of what we saw in 2007 and 2008 at the top. Because back then, we saw a major high in July of 2007 on the S&P, and then a very serious break into early September 2007, late August, early September 2007. And then there was a just a similar type of V-type bottom where prices came back up and made new highs in October of 2007. So this seems like it's happening on a grander scale, but it's almost the same type of potential formation. And what's more, a lot of the momentum and internal characteristics are very similar as well. So I think when you look at how tremendous the advance has been in stocks since 2009. Most investors, this stage of the game, this looks like it's an opportunity to be watching stock prices very closely if they do start to tip over in the weeks and months ahead. And I'm not saying in the short term, but keep an eye on the major trend on some of those key moving averages as we move forward, because you know you don't want to end up giving back if the market does build a big top. And we are 9 years into the cycle. That's the kind of thing where you don't want to give back those excellent and outstanding long-term gains. So maybe it's good to be thinking a little bit about having the defense out on the field.
Let's talk about the other market, which is the bond market. We saw interest rates rise along with oil and inflation prices heading into the fall. We got up to 75, 76 bucks on WTI. Frank, now we're in the, we just got a favorable inventory report on the day you and I are speaking, and oil prices are approaching 65, Brent's over 70. When you're looking at commodities, whether you're looking at gold, you're looking at oil, you're looking at copper, commodities are also rising. So let's talk about interest rates first, and then I want to hit commodities.
Sure. You know, everybody, a lot of around the world, there have been a lot of commentators over the last few months talking, people that I really respect, people like Jeffrey Gundlach, not among the least, who have been saying, you know, they thought interest rates would move up and, you know, the rally in bonds is over, bonds is moving into a bear market. I'm really not sure I agree with that. It looks like interest rates, the 10-year, may have hit a meaningful cyclical top at the high around 324 back in October of last year. And the way they've come, rates have come down off those highs seems reflective of a slowdown that's developing. Now, I think it's worthwhile remembering that every time you get into a slowdown, especially in this case, potentially a global slowdown, there tends to be the early months of every recession, you always have inflation moving up because inflation lags. So producers move down the supply curve, they produce less and they raise prices. As they start to sense that aggregate demand is coming in, they just cut back production, they move down the supply curve and they tend to raise prices. So sometimes you can actually be starting to slip into a slowdown and see inflation still moving up. Things like copper tend to top in that period of time. I think that we are looking at a very potentially explosive situation in certain bond markets, especially the European bond markets. I think that's where the problems are really serious. And maybe later on, the U.S. bond market could get into trouble. But right now, I'm a bond bull. I think the U.S. is a relative key of stability. The slowdown in China looks like it's been gathering momentum over the last few months. I know a lot of people are looking for a second half bounce. We'll have to see about that. But the slowdown in China has definitely been pulling down growth in Europe. And Europe is facing a lot of challenges. There's the potential issue with Brexit. There's also elections coming up where a lot of the parties that are a lot of the establishment is really being contested by sort of fringe anti-euro parties, especially in Italy. And when I look at the charts of European bonds, which are paying virtually nothing, a lot of those charts seem to be building big bases, so in yields. But I think there could be political turmoil in Europe that could destabilize things and start forcing yields up. And comparatively speaking, I think money could come into the United States and compress U.S. yields even further. So the U.S. might look like a relative paragon of safety if Europe runs into trouble. And I really wouldn't be surprised to see the 10-year moving down below 2% over time. In terms of commodities, a lot is also going to depend on trade. If we do have tariffs, if for some reason the deal with China does not go through and is not completed in a way where the tariffs are removed, or especially if no further tariffs are imposed, that's one thing. That's a positive scenario. If we get a decent deal, that's one thing. But if that deal falls apart and we go to a regime of imposing higher tariffs on China, or if there's a tariff issue with Europe on autos and some of the other sticking points, that gets worse, then I think you've got bigger problems. That's probably going to force an accelerated slowdown over time, and that could actually be an engine for a bear market. I mean, protectionism is not a good thing. We saw that in the 1930s, and we've been sort of tap dancing around the edge of it over the last year. A lot depends on how that really goes. If that can go positively, then maybe equity markets could make, another could extend the bull market and yields could stay relatively low. But if it doesn't, then I think we've got a whole different set of problems coming our way.
You know, the one thing that really strikes me, whether you're looking at Europe, where probably a third of the yields are negative, you look at Japan, same likewise, you look at debt levels, even though we're approaching $23 trillion, Europe is worse, Japan is worse, China is worse. So the old saw, Frank, we have the best looking shirt in a dirty laundry basket, which makes the U.S. the place to be.
At the moment, that's right. And it certainly are, you know, the spreads vis-a-vis Europe, our U.S. 10-year versus the German Bund, that's over 200 basis points. So that really tells you that our bond market is pulling in money. I do, and I am very mindful of the arguments that are being put out. You know, Jeff Gundlach has made the case. He said, you know, we've never seen a fiscal increase like this late in a cycle. And if we do slow down into a recession, the deficits are going to be huge. The interest payments on the debt are going to be huge. Essentially, the U.S. is falling into a fiscal debt trap. I think there's a lot of substance behind that. And over time, that certainly could be something that could adversely affect the bond market. But right now, I think there's a risk that we could see instability in China and instability in Europe as a catalyst for a bear market and possibly, you know, more risk on the trade front. And that would create a lot of uncertainty. And I think the one asset, if things do go south in the months ahead, and it's just, I'm not predicting that. I'm really a big believer in following the trend of the market. And right now that trend is still up. But if you do get sell signals in the months ahead, I wouldn't be surprised if gold became a chief beneficiary. That's the one commodity I think could really do a talk to the hand and go straight up if this cycle rolls over hard at the end. Because really, when you look at it, central banks will have very, very little in the way of ammunition left in the coffers to deal with a down cycle. I mean, interest rates are already low. In the case of the ECB, the balance sheet has ballooned up tremendously. So you're looking at the potential for an economic contraction to wreak havoc in terms of politics and some of these relationships that have been in place for a long time. And the resulting uncertainty and all of that could be a powerful driver for gold. And gold looks like it's filling out a huge base that it's been in for 5 years with key resistance of 1355 to 1365. If it moves through that, I wouldn't be at all surprised to see it move to 1500 and then eventually to new all-time highs. So keep an eye on the gold market. I think for a lot of investors, there's some really good opportunities there, and that's something that could shape up in the second half of the year.
You know, that's the thing that really strikes me. There's so many potential catalysts coming from Europe, or let's say taking a look at problems in China. You've got problems in South America. And I wonder, Frank, if that's one reason why the Fed pivoted so quickly and did a 180. I mean, the U.S. economy is still doing well. It was slowing down. But I wonder if some of the international issues going on in Europe, China, Japan had an influence on the Fed's thinking.
The whole question, whether the Trump administration, you know, should have tackled trade with China, that's pretty much moot at this stage of the game. They've gone there. A lot of people do think that there were, you know, really legitimate issues that are being brought into play and that you know, there's a lot to discuss. And so the question is just how, you know, how much teeth are they going to, you know, there were a lot of questions about the U.S. wanting to help China, basically have China change the organization of the state-owned enterprises and supporting the state-owned enterprises. And I think we've realized, hey, that's not going to happen. But just how much enforcement and discipline is going to be built into the intellectual property and the transfer of technology, these are huge issues which aren't going to determine billions of future earnings. It's going to be trillions of future earnings. And I think the U.S. is trying to draw an intelligent line in the sand with China, where something, or even where for China, if China goes off and develops, you know, new intellectual property, then they own it and they can benefit it. So I think this is intelligent. It's just a question of, is it going to come full circle? And then, of course, there's a lot of geopolitical issues between U.S. and China with the South China Sea and Chinese hegemony in that part of the world. They really, I think, don't want the U.S. In their corner of the world anymore, sailing carrier battle groups through the Strait of Malacca. I think they're really trying to tell us, listen, back off. We want our sphere of influence the same way you guys have your sphere of influence. And so I think underpinning these trade negotiations is also a lot of geopolitical haggling in terms of U.S. and its relationship to Taiwan and other things. So, I mean, I think this is more complex than it seems, and that makes it a lot dicier. And the markets have run up here on the assumption that it's a layup. And I'm not so sure that that layup is a well-placed bet. I'm not trying to be negative, but I think a healthy dose of skepticism is certainly in order.
So given all this, Frank, given where the markets are right now, and as you say, good possibility that we break out above the old highs, what would you be doing as an investor?
You know, at this stage of the game, I have to be honest, Jim, my advice would be, and this may not be perfect for everyone, there's certainly no, you know, one size fits all, but I would be taking some money off the table in equities. I think I would be shifting certainly asset allocations to a more defensive posture. And, you know, maybe ring the register in stages. There's never a good idea to do everything on one day or at one time. So maybe, you know, going forward, we just sort of take a look at it and see how are things progressing. But we're near the 50-week upper Bollinger Band on things like the QQQs. They're kind of coming in a natural resistance spot. Things like the 9-week RSI are now fully overbought at 75. There's just a lot of reasons to be going really slow up here. I wouldn't be at all surprised to see this market congest up in a range for a couple of months. Maybe, you know, on the right side of a double top, you usually will build a reversal pattern, you know, so you'll start to see a lot of chop up and down, moving back and forth. And then if we end up defining some kind of a support area and we break it, I would take that. Right, and especially if the news background is deteriorating, I would take that as a clear out type of thing. I would be moving into bonds, high quality bonds like treasury bonds, maybe some high grade corporates or some really high quality munis. And I'd certainly be keeping a close watch on the gold market moving forward. I kind of get the feeling that somewhere in here, the Trump administration would love to come up with an end game that pushes the dollar down, because I think that would help corporate America. And if we do end up in a bear market, cutting interest rates and moving back to QE could be something where the dollar starts to move into a bear trend. It's been pretty strong lately. So any kind of breakdown in the dollar index would be interesting to observe. I think that would only feed into and enforce a bullish case for gold.
All right. Well, listen, Frank, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. I guess the word is, with markets at this high level, maybe a good idea to start shifting some profits off the table and build up a defensive position. I would say that pretty much sums up what you're thinking.
I would say that's good. Sometimes you can never go too wrong. You got to pay taxes, but taking a profit is not a bad idea. So thanks so much, Jim. I really appreciate it.
Okay, Frank, thanks so much. All the best.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
I've done extensive study on the yield curve, and my conclusion has been is that yield curve inversions are not actually good predictors of recessions. They're not actually good statistically if you look at them closely, but mainly they're not really good predictors from a conceptual point of view, because there's really no clear conceptual explanation for why yield curve inversion should actually signal a recession. So any statistical correlation that can be found between yield curve inversions and subsequent recessions is probably just coincidental, because there really isn't a very good conceptual explanation on why that should work at all.
The price of gold recently has had a nice run, especially since the end of December. We tried to pass 1325 and had difficulty staying there. Will we go back and retest and move higher? Or was that just a dead cat bounce? Joining me on the program is Keith Barron. He's CEO of Arania Resources. And Keith, I want to talk about the gold industry of which you're a part of. And in particular, I want to talk about the major acquisitions we've seen over the last year, especially Barrick and Newmont. And even though both have made major acquisitions from Rand Gold to Goldcorp, they were also talking about the possibility of merging together. So what's going on there?
Well, I think that the market is turning around. These deals could not have been done a year ago. And because certainly the accretive nature and the banking industry and everything else wouldn't have looked too favorable upon it. But there are a lot of people bullish about the price of gold right now. And I think a lot of that is coming from central bank buying. We've seen more central bank buying recently than we've seen in a long, long time, especially from China. And that's certainly keeping the price stable. It did break through 1300 very recently and drifted back, but it hasn't drifted back much. It's certainly not gone back to a 1000 or 1100. So it's keeping fairly stable. So I think there are a lot of companies right now in the gun sights of the majors. You know, we saw this one deal take place between Randgold and Barrick, and for a matter of a couple of days, the combined entity was the largest gold company in the world, but only for a few days, and then Newmont swanned in with Goldcorp, and now they've taken the top spot again. And I wouldn't be at all surprised to see some more acquisitions go on by potentially both parties for one-upmanship. And certainly Mr. Bristow, I think, has aspirations to be the largest, run the largest gold company in the world and stay on top. So it's a very interesting dynamic that we're witnessing right now. Also, we're seeing recently a lot of deals being done where majors are taking positions in juniors, not just through joint ventures, but through taking equity positions and fairly sizable chunks. And this is always a signal to the market that, probably this is just going to be used as a stepping stone to acquire them down the road. But they're just not in the space yet where they feel comfortable doing the entire takeover. They probably want to see the asset more de-risked. But certainly this is all part of the merger and acquisition stuff that's going on these days.
What does it tell you, Keith? I know at one time Barrick was one of the largest companies. Newmont, I think at one time they were producing over 7 million ounces of gold. And then, of course, they couldn't replace or find what they were producing, so production dropped from 7 down to 5. So if they go on this acquisition binge, as they're doing now, and they become bigger, doesn't that even create a bigger problem of trying to replace what they're producing? In other words, so let's say they take their production up to 7 and 8 million ounces a year because of acquisition. What are they going to do to replace the 8 million ounces of gold that they produce each year?
More acquisitions. I think that's the only answer. Can't go out and find it. It's just takes too long. It's too difficult. And as I've said on your show many a time, a lot of the low hanging fruit has been picked, and there's just not those huge, massive deposits out there that used to be found maybe one or two a year. Now we can go through 2, 3, 5 years and not come up with something that's a real whopper. So this is the problem that the industry faces, and it's only going to get worse. You know, we've already moved down the food chain, so to speak, so that we're mining sub gram per ton levels of gold. Certainly, when I started my career a good 30 years ago, we would never, ever look at that kind of stuff. And now, you know, that's the only kind of stuff that's out there in abundance. So a lot of the projects have become massive, massive earth-moving operations to get the same number of ounces. In other words, you have to mine a much, much greater volume of rock if it's low grade to yield you the same number of ounces of gold. And this is what the industry is doing.
Keith, why do you think Newmont and Barrick have not merged? I mean, they operate in the same locale in the Carlin Trend in Nevada. So it would make some kind of sense to have some kind of mutual agreement between the two with cost savings because they're both mining in the same area. Is it egos? Is it like, I want to be the big guy on the block, so I'm not going to be second fiddle to you? Is it egos that is stopping this? Because it seems like it would make a lot of sense.
Yeah, well, I think it's part of all of this. Really, the biggest problem, and I've seen this quoted in the media, is that they will never, ever be able to replace the ounces, and they know it. So they're just avoiding the problem by, you know, a lot of posturing, of course, and a lot of puffing out of chest. But at the end of the day, I don't think we are ever going to see a merger of these two companies.
So, Keith, when you have these majors, basically the only mining that they seem to be doing is on Wall Street. So if I was an investor, why would I want to buy a Newmont or, let's say, a Barrick that's not replacing its reserves and is always buying somebody else? Wouldn't I be better off as an investor to pick up a company that has a nice-sized deposit and is a potential acquisition target versus buying the big guys?
Well, I think that's the methodology any savvy investor would follow these days, because the majors are really just moving sideways. The mid-tier seem to be doing better. And because of this merger frenzy, you know, if you have a mid-tier company, I'm not going to mention any names here, but of course we all know them, you might get a 30 or 40% bump on the acquisition. Maybe it's a good idea to place some of your investment into mid-tiers. You're getting the same reward and exposure with the gold price, really. There are a couple that are stronger than others, of course, and you have to do your due diligence. Certainly, I've always liked the juniors, and I'm in the junior space, running a junior company, because a junior company can go basically from zero to hero in 50 seconds flat. Just by making a discovery.
So let's talk about juniors. As I look at some of these indexes, let's take something like the GDX. It pretty much is following the same pattern that you're seeing in gold. It's gone up. Now it's gone basically sideways in a consolidation. You know, when you look at all these gold charts, I don't care if you're looking at the XAU, the GDX, looking at the price of gold, they all look about the same. I want to talk about two other metals. I want to talk about specifically silver and then also copper. The stories I read, Keith, is that copper is in short supply. In other words, the inventories are down and they're not replacing what they're producing, much like gold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the copper story, I think, is very, very special. And all your listeners really need to pay attention to it, because this... in my opinion, the setup for copper right now is unlike anything that we've seen in copper for even more than 100 years. And I'll quantify that by saying, you know, we are going to have such a demand in future for copper, for electric cars, and for charging networks, that it's going to be very similar to the renaissance in copper mining that you had, especially in the U.S., when Bingham Canyon was open in Butte in Montana, and America was electrified. And, you know, all these all the electricity lines were strung from poles across America, and then the same thing got duplicated in Europe. I'm talking about the time around when Thomas Edison was around. So I think really that's going to be coming for copper, because the world wants to abandon the petroleum engine. There's 25 kilos of copper used in a typical gasoline-powered car, and there's 75 kilos in an electric car, and that is a big difference. The governments of the world have been talking and jawboning about doing away with gasoline-powered cars, especially in the EU, but nobody ever talks about where the copper is going to come from to power these things. Now, the battery situation, we have different types of batteries. We've got different choices here. And at the end of the day, I don't know if lithium is going to be the go-to thing in the future. The same with cobalt and with nickel. But for conduction of electricity, there's no way that we can replace or duplicate the utility of copper. So the pundits are saying that we're going to have to find one escondida per year going forward. Escondida is the world's largest copper deposit. We have to find one of them every year because it's going to get consumed. Isn't that amazing?
Well, you know, it's the same thing with oil. If you look at Saudi Arabia, which has the largest oil field in the world, Garwar, some recent studies have come out that the production at Garwar, which is well over 50 years old, is much less than originally thought. And it's probably the same with that large copper mine. So, Keith, if they're not finding large gold deposits and they're not finding large copper deposits, that sooner or later, basic economics, when you're talking about all this, you know, smart devices we have, from our smartphones to our iPads to electric cars, people forget that all this technology still takes basic minerals to manufacture.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, you know, there are some young people who are under the delusion that we can get all of our metal from recycling. But the Earth's population is going to be 8 billion soon, and it's just going up and up, and everyone aspires to own things like cell phones and cars and air conditioning units and things that require metals. So what is happening in the gold situation and in the copper situation is that we are attacking deposits which are lower and lower grade, in some cases going back to deposits that we thought were really worked out, and just going back to take the dregs that are left behind. And, well, there's not many people doing what I do and going out into the frontier areas looking for this stuff, just simply because there aren't many left. Maybe in future we're going to have to mine asteroids or go to Mars.
Well, maybe we're going to the moon. Maybe that's why we're doing it. Keith, you've been in this industry 3 decades. We saw a great upcycle in the 70s, early 80s, when Barrick became a major company. Then we saw a big upcycle in the last decade where a lot of money went into exploration. How would you contrast where we are today compared to, let's say, the previous 2 cycles?
Well, I think the setup today is very similar to what we saw in 2001. So companies are just starting to raise money again, and they're starting to get out there and make new discoveries. In 2001, we saw the internet NASDAQ thing crash away, and that had been sucking a lot of venture capital away from the junior market. So juniors couldn't raise any money. Now it's been cryptos, it's been cannabis. I think crypto has had its day now. Certainly in cannabis now, in countries like Canada, it's now legal, and we're seeing a lot of mergers of the players, and really the fast money has already been made. So I think that really all we need is a catalyst here. We need a couple of companies to make some discoveries, and you'll see a lot of money come back into the sector. You know, the situation in America with debt is as high, it's as bad as it's ever been. The interest rates are still scary low, and people aren't being paid to lend money, and people are looking for yield. And if you start seeing the mid tier and the junior companies starting to move and move in a real definite way, then I think we could see a turnover and a lot of money going into the sector. And I do mean a lot of money. You know, it is a very, very small sector compared to other things. I mean, when you compare the market cap of a company like Newmont to McDonald's or to Walt Disney or anything like this, it just takes really a small amount of money to be funneled into the industry to start making a real difference.
And Keith, as you know, you talk about a catalyst. One of the catalysts that I see, and we read stories about this, the U.S. debt is approaching $23 trillion. China's debt to GDP ratio is almost 300%. Similar in Japan, we've got debt issues throughout all of Europe. My goodness, a third of the debt in Europe has negative interest rates. And we're hearing in the U.S. a new theory to justify debt and spending a lot of money. It's called MMT, Modern Monetary Theory. And it goes that a government can raise and as much debt as it wants as long as it's done in its own currency. So you have right now the economic justification that's being made, and both parties are subscribing to this, to basically print a bunch of money and spend a bunch of money. And to me, that could be the catalyst that I see coming in the next decade.
Well, it's as screwball and crazy as a lot of Keynesian economics. It's just not going to work, you know, like it or not. I remember when the value of the U.S. dollar took a tumble in the last administration, and Obama said, oh, it doesn't really matter because most people don't travel outside the U.S. Well, you know, there's all these goods that stream into the U.S. every day. And you know, it can't just be a situation where the Americans mess up their currency and drop the value of it against everyone else, because everyone will be doing the same thing. So it's beggar thy neighbor policy. We've seen that before in trade wars. You know, maybe that's coming. I don't know. Maybe to really jumpstart the economy. But whatever the catalyst will be, we've seen it all before. I've been through 5-6 cycles since I started in this business. And there's always something that comes around, crisis of some sort. And it's as unexpected, perhaps, as that horrible fire at Notre Dame. You know, these things just come out of like a bolt out of the blue. You know, the economic situation is shaky. It's precarious. There's any host of things that could certainly boost the gold price and the silver price significantly. And I think you just have to sit tight and watch.
Well, it just seems to me with the big guys basically doing mining on Wall Street, the best way to prospect would be take a look at what they're mining for. Keith, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out more information about the company that you run, why don't you give out your website and tell them how they could do so?
Thank you, Jim. The company is Aurania Resources, and that's spelled AURANIA.com. And there you'll find a heck of a lot of information about the company and some videos starring yours truly, which I hope will be entertaining and instructive.
All right. Well, as always, Keith, thanks so much for joining us on the program. All the best and have a great weekend.
Thanks so much for having me.
And in hour two, the big picture, marijuana, lucrative leaf or harmful herb? On this edition of the big picture, Jim Poplav and I, we get into the weeds on the marijuana debate. We also talk about legalization, cannabis companies going public, and big tobacco and beverage companies investing in those companies. Also, the possibility of legalization at the federal level. Possible harmful effects of cannabis. And though the U.S. has 5% of the world population, we have 25% of the world's incarcerated. How do recent changes in cannabis laws relate to America's devastating mass incarceration problem? We discuss all of that in Hour 2, The Big Picture.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.